I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about one of the most consequential American presidents of the 20th century, Ronald Reagan. But we're not going to be taking our usual detailed historical look at Reagan and his presidency. We're going to be stepping back and looking at an important theme for understanding Reagan and his importance for America. That is the statesmanship of Ronald Reagan. How was he a statesman? In what way was he a statesman? How do we see that in the big themes of his public life? And I'm joined for that conversation by Professor Greg McBrayer. You may know him as a listener to this podcast. Our audience, let me start again. You may know Greg as a guest on this podcast. He has been helping us develop this for a very long time, and he has studied statesmanship in depth. All the way from the ancient writings of Xenophon, the disciple of Socrates, to contemporary times, and including the presidency of Ronald Reagan. In fact, Greg grew up in West Berlin during the time that Reagan was president. And he is one of the faculty members who has joined us for our new Ashbrook online masterclass called Tear Down This Wall. It's a study of Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and the fight for freedom. You can find that course at courses.ashbrook.org. The links will be in the notes. And I thought we'd want to get a taste of that course today by having this conversation with Greg about Ronald Reagan and his statesmanship. Greg, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Great to talk about Ronald Reagan. Even have my Ronald Reagan socks on today.
Ah, fantastic. Yeah. Ronald Reagan, of course, everybody's heard the name, right? All our listeners who are pretty historically informed, as you know, they know Ronald Reagan. Many of them remember Ronald Reagan from the time that he was president. But the idea that Reagan has taken on an importance in the pantheon of American presidents, and people have compared him, you know, to Washington, Lincoln, FDR. It's not uncommon to hear that kind of language, which is pretty high praise. Maybe to understand Ronald Reagan and his life and his statesmanship, you could take us back to Ronald Reagan before he's president and the significance of Ronald Reagan and his career until 1980.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Probably one of the top two most influential presidencies of the 20th century. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, as you mentioned, and Ronald Reagan, those have to be up there. And you also mentioned sort of world historical figures in the 20th century, statesmen. I mean, Churchill, Roosevelt, Thatcher, Reagan. I mean, it's sort of, I guess, Gandhi, perhaps. Maybe you want to say, throw him on there as well. But yeah, and I mean, you know, the statesmanship is something that maybe one achieves at the pinnacle of one's career. But you're right. I mean, the seeds for this statesmanship are much earlier. And you can see, even when he's an actor, that Reagan begins to turn to more serious matters still relatively early in life. You know, of course, he makes his famous political debut giving this this speech called A Time for Choosing in 1964. It takes a little bit of courage, I suppose. He gives a speech in defense of Barry Goldwater's campaign, and it's pretty clear to everybody by this point that that campaign is not succeeding. You might say that liberalism is sort of at its high watermark, by which I mean sort of progressive liberalism, right? The Great Society is, I mean, Goldwater is going to get trounced. And there's one aspect of statesmanship that I've never really fully grasped, and it's that people like Reagan, I would say Churchill, they can kind of see things far off. They can see farther than the rest of us, or they can maybe comprehend is the right word. Like literally they're just putting things together and they can see how it unfolds. And so, of course, I mean, Reagan's a part of this unfolding. So, I mean, to that extent, maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But to see that the world is, America even, is ready for a sort of return to the principles that made America great in the first place in 1776, to see that and then to try to help execute it is I think, an extraordinary act of statesmanship, even that early in his career. You know, when everybody else is talking about progress and we need to, the world has changed and times have changed, in 1964, to begin to praise the founding, the principles in the Declaration, to quote them in the speech, to talk about the wisdom of the Constitution, to talk about, to speak about limited government as though that's a good idea. I mean, this is not the era of limited government, 1964. And so you see it early on, and then you see after this, I mean, this speech is sort of really transforms Reagan into a national figure, at least within the Republican Party. And so then it's off to being a governor of California, where he has successful terms. He makes an attempt to oust Ford in 76, not successful, but then in 1980, extraordinarily successful and just really, really, you know, it's 2025 right now, and Donald Trump has just won a fairly decisive election, but I mean, I think we sort of don't remember what really decisive elections look like anymore because we haven't seen one in so long. I mean, Reagan really, really wins in 1980 and then 1984, whereas he only loses one state. Is that right? So it's really kind of impressive. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say early on, his speeches are really important. I mean, he was a military man. Reagan was, although largely serving in sort of office duty kind of capacity. So it's not like he had the young military career of a Churchill or something like that. And so that's not quite there, and maybe we can talk a little bit later about the ways in which I think Reagan nevertheless distinguished himself by his courage, despite not having done some of the traditional things that we might associate with statesmanship, especially, you know, the Greeks, like you mentioned, going all the way back. Typically, we think of people as sort of military leaders and that sort of thing. Reagan was not that.
Well, I think when I think of a statesman, I think of some qualities that distinguish them from, on the one hand, just a leader,
right,
or a mere politician.
Right, right, right.
And one of the things that I think about is the point you mentioned there, that a statesman has principles.
Right.
They're what Margaret Thatcher called conviction politicians.
Right.
Right. That the principles are why they're seeking public office. And they seek to establish or reestablish or strengthen the principles that they think should be governing society. That seems very clear in that important speech you mentioned of Reagan in 1964, A Time for Choosing. Tell us a little bit about Reagan's principles.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And I'll just first, I want to echo what you just said, that the principles are there. I mean, how many politicians, even very successful politicians, where really it seems to be about the person and not about the ideas or the principles. And, you know, the principles are really central. Words are really central to statesmanship. You know, I think of the 19th century's greatest statesman for the United States, Lincoln. I mean, you go to the Lincoln Monument and there are speeches on the sides of the walls that sort of envelop him. And so it's sort of, I think we're disinclined maybe to take seriously the idea that principles and the articulation of those principles really is at the heart of what it means to be a statesman. And for Reagan, I mean, if I had to I could probably just boil it down to one word, in fact, freedom. I mean, I think that you can sort of trace everything in his thought to freedom. I mean, he was bold in domestic politics. He was bold in thinking about the economy. He was bold in thinking about foreign policy. And in all these areas, really, it was human beings, when they are free, to pursue excellence and happiness in their own way, that's going to be a greater outcome for everyone involved, not just the individuals, but it's going to resound to the benefit of others. And this is why, you know, he supported anti-communists, guerrillas around the world. This is why he supported deregulation. That's why he supported lower taxes. I mean, really, it is about freedom. And that also means, therefore, that there's a kind of moral clarity about, so freedom is good, and therefore regimes that try to stifle human freedom and the human spirit even are evil. And he was not afraid to say that. And that takes a kind of courage as well. So, yeah, I mean, freedom, freedom, freedom. You know, and a willingness to stand up for that and a willingness to do things that are unpopular. You know, I'm thinking of course, firing all the air traffic controllers early in his first administration, right? Like, that takes an extraordinary amount of courage because you know you're going to face some heat for that. But also it takes a clear dedication to a set of principles, right? There's something about labor unions in the public sector being somewhat problematic. It seems how who's arguing with you at that point. So, yeah, just a small example.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because he has a clear statement of principles there in that 1964 speech. Another component of statesmanship, as you mentioned, though, is courage, right? Because some leaders don't have principles, or they have very bad principles, right? Mm-hmm. So they're unjust. But But a lot of politicians might talk principles, but they don't really have the courage in decisive moments to stand firm on those principles and actually say, no, I'm serious about these principles. Right. We have to try to get them into effect or restore them or reestablish them. Reagan's courage, sure. Where and how do we see that in his early life?
Let me take a step back. So you mentioned having some clear principles. I think that's an essential element. Courage, which I'll come to since you've asked about it. Intelligence, I think, is part of it. Although, you know, Reagan was sort of notoriously a C student, but clearly shows a clarity.
Yeah, so what do you mean by intelligence?
Right. I mean, well, kind of what I was talking about a little bit before about seeing the way the world works and being able to implement things. So, like, here's an example that I think of that combines his intelligence with his courage. So, I mean, there's something that Reagan did early in his presidency that took a lot of courage, defied conventional wisdom, and he took a lot of heat for it. But it took courage and the intelligence to see that this plan could work. What should the United States or the free world do with respect to communism? His most immediate predecessors had practiced something called détente, which is that we should try to ease relations with the Soviet Union. This is the best way to sort of carve a path to peace in the future. And then before that, there was the policy of containment, which was, you know, I think probably a little bit better of an idea, but still his idea is we're just going to stop communism from growing, but wherever it is, it's fine. Reagan thought détente was foolish, and containment wasn't far enough, that we actually have to think about ways to, now, of course, carefully and moderately and not everywhere all at once, but oppose communism, in fact. And if there are anti-communist sort of forces in various countries, that we should support them. So in other words, he takes on a much more aggressive tone toward the Soviet Union. And this, you know, everyone's like, what are you doing? Why would you provoke them? I mean, he starts an arms race, for God's sake. You know, and I don't know if you've studied any game theory, but this is like a game of chicken. Like, who's going to blink first? But he saw that the Soviet economy could not, and Soviet technology, there's no freedom in the Soviet Union, so therefore their scientists aren't going to have the intellectual freedom to be able to pursue these things. There's no incentives for people to do it. And also the economy, because the economy is command-controlled, they're not going to be able to have the resources to put into, they can't keep up with us. They can't produce the intelligence to do it. They can't produce the raw materials to do it. They just can't keep up with us. And then he saw, I mean, by his second term already, we're talking about arms reduction. So there's this pivot, and it's like one could say that that's unprincipled. Well, on the one hand, he's doing an arms race, and then he's going to arms reduction. How does that make sense? No, it makes sense because the goal all along was peace and undermining the capacity of the Soviet Union. So we'll build up to bring them to the bargaining table to then start to implement reductions. I mean, you know, his opponents always labeled him a warmonger, but really what Reagan wanted through and through was peace. If you look at his speech from March 23rd, 1983, where he addressed the country on national defense and national security, I mean, he closes with this resounding call for peace. Like, the scientists gave us the bomb. I'm calling on scientists to help us develop the means to mitigate its potentially disastrous effects. So there's courage there. There's intelligence there. I mean, there's a long sight. He sort of has a long-sighted view, right? There's I know where I want to get. The strategy to get there means that tactics might change over time. I'm willing to discuss, collaborate. I'm willing to cooperate. But we got to get folks to the table to where we can do it on terms that are important for us. So that I think took a lot of courage, the arms race, and yeah. Then it's a courage to part from it. By the way,
well, so that's interesting. So it's a courage that's flexible. By that I mean sometimes the courage is to say we're going to take this course and our principles require taking this course. But then you have to have the courage to say, okay, circumstances are different. For example, Mikhail Gorbachev has come into power.
Right.
Gorbachev is adaptable. Gorbachev is flexible in a way that previous Soviet leaders were not. And I think Thatcher convinced Reagan of that. And so right. Now he has to have the courage to pivot away right. from arms buildup toward arms reduction or arms control or strategic defense as opposed to strategic offense.
Yeah. And I think any military general, right, of course, would know that tactics need to change, and even strategy might need to change at certain points. And so that adaptability, but still guided by what's the ultimate goal? We want more freedom in the world, and we want to reduce the influence of the Soviet Union and communism around the world. And on those scores, I think he was successful. I mean, Gorbachev comes to the table, as you mentioned, and he's already talking about changing the Soviet Union, perestroika and glasnost, making it more open and making some changes. I don't even know if you get a Gorbachev without a first term of Ronald Reagan. I'm not so sure you do.
So that current, that's interesting. So the principles are always operating, and this fundamental principle of freedom, which, as you point out, really informs both his domestic policy and his foreign policy,
Yes.
and his courage to be bold, but to be flexible and intelligent, seeing the whole picture, right? And the other thing, the other maybe, and this is maybe this is just part of intelligence, but I usually think of a statesman in the way that, for example, Aristotle talks about it, as someone who has what he calls prudence
Right.
or practical wisdom.
Yeah.
Did Reagan have that? Because he was famously not seen to be like he was no Henry Kissinger, right? He was no Richard Nixon. He wasn't a deep, apparently, didn't appear to be a deep student of politics,
Right.
didn't know all the details of budgets like Jimmy Carter. Did he have prudence?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that maybe one part of prudence is kind of what I was alluding to earlier, this ability to sort of comprehend and see how things might play out and see that if I, like in chess, like if I move here, I can see 3 or 4 steps down the road what my opponent's going to do. And yeah, and by the way, of course, Reagan was sort of, people frequently made fun of him for not being a very serious thinker, and he's sort of simple. But that there's that great Saturday Night Live sketch. I don't know if you remember it, where they sort of had Reagan. He was with kids, and he was all shocks and oh country, oh gosh, And then the kids would leave, and his cabinet would come in, and he was just barking out orders and going over it very clearly in lines. So I think that some folks kind of recognized that his avuncular style was a bit of an act, and that he actually was a more serious thinker than he let on. And that's at least the account we get from some of his closer associates. Yeah. And I mean, like I said, like the ability to see, I mean, the ability to see, for example, that what this country needs is a return and to go back to a founding. I mean, Machiavelli talks about this, the necessity of regimes to go back to their founding principles when no one else saw that. To see, I mean, who else in the night, early night, I mean, I grew up in West Berlin. Who else? I mean, Reagan seems to have been one of the handful of people who saw that we could actually bring the Soviet Union's collapse about without war. I mean, he saw that they were economically unsound. I mean, in the 1970s, this was not people's view of things. And I do think that that's a kind of prudence to see that the enemy, as it were, is not as militarily and economically and even morally strong as it appears to be. And I think that actually maybe that last point above all is what leads to the other things. It's not morally sound precisely because it can't be economically sound and can't be militarily sound. So I do think that that's prudence to see how to get from point A to point B.
That's really interesting because I think a lot of people, Reagan, as you said, was one of the few American presidents, or the most, the clearest to say. I mean, Jimmy Carter certainly injected a concern for human rights into American
Yes.
policy,
Right,
right?
right, right.
In a way that was not present previously under or Nixon or Ford. But the Carter administration wanted to hold every regime accountable for its stance on human rights, including our allies, right?
Right,
So
right.
the Reagan administration famously says, we're not going to criticize our allies first. We're going
Yeah.
to criticize the Soviet Union first on
Right.
human rights. And in fact, he goes in, I think it's 1983, where he calls the Soviet Union an evil empire.
Right.
People at the time, including his own advisors, said, please don't do that. What are you doing?
To be able, on the one hand, to call them evil, and then to be able to bound down some stairs to sort of wrap a coat around Mikhail Gorbachev at one of the SALT meetings, right? One can imagine other presidents having such harsh words, but then never having the light touch and the gentle open hand. And so the fact, this is a capacity, again, that Reagan, he was able to say these things, tear down this wall, evil empire, and never to somehow alienate entirely his opponents, it seemed. That he was able still to negotiate with the Soviet Union. I mean, to be completely morally clear. And by the way, another point is that the regime is evil, right? It's not the people who are evil, and focusing on that part of it, and sort of showing that there's sympathy for the people who are suffering under the Soviet regime, as opposed to sort of one can imagine an alternative where it's just they're bad because their government's bad and everyone's bad. One sees this, I think, with China a little bit today, whereas Reagan sort of wants to distinguish the character of the regime from the people under its tyranny. And so, yeah, I mean, calling a spade, that's a sort of moral clarity. It takes a kind of courage, a conviction to be able to say that and to do that, especially when your advisors are saying, don't do it. But yeah, I mean, and, but it's, I think he also saw, maybe this is another point worth emphasizing, that simply saying those words isn't empty rhetoric. Those words have an effect. Words have an effect. You're signaling to the Soviet Union your beliefs. You're also signaling domestically, hey, we're better than them. And I think that confidence had been lacking in the United States in itself for at least the previous decade.
Well, so you said, as you said, you grew up in West Berlin, or at least a part of your childhood and young adult years, you were in West Berlin. What effect did it have on Eastern Europe for Reagan to call the Soviet Union an evil empire?
I mean, I could tell you on the West, I mean, huge impact, right? I mean, for folks to know, and I mean, you get this from Czech dissidents, you get it from dissidents in East Germany and the Soviet Union themselves. I mean, a lot of these guys will say that hearing Reagan say this so clearly to us gave us energy to continue to work to undermine the regime as best we could. I mean, the West Berliners went crazy. I mean, this was, you know, this is their own city that's been divided in half by the evil Soviet Union, basically, right? So it gave a kind of moral confidence to people that Reagan had your back, that the West supports you, and that we don't think that this the tyranny of the Soviet Union is going to last forever. I mean, then by the way, you know, Mr. Gorbachev teared down this wall in East Berlin that separates East and West Berlin, right? Which is, I mean, technically, of course, that's the East German government, it's not the Soviet Union. But so clearly, like, no, the Soviet Unions are the ones who are pulling the strings here, and we know that they're in charge, and that they're the ones who should open up the gate. So. Yeah, I mean, it was a beacon of light. There were all kinds of these little symbols. Of course, we Reagan really amped up a lot of the radio propaganda during the time, which I think was important and supported folks. A huge moral support for folks.
Hi, I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center. And I want to let you know about our newest free Ashbrook Masterclass. It's called Tear Down This Wall, Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and the fight for freedom. In this online course, which is available for students, teachers, and citizens, you'll learn about the challenges these leaders face and how their faith in freedom helped them overcome some of the greatest threats to life and liberty that humanity has ever faced. Sign up for Tear Down This Wall today and join us for a wonderful adventure as we deepen our understanding of what it takes to fight for freedom and perpetuate our ongoing experiment in self-government. We look forward to you joining us.
Reagan, when in his pivot, when he pivots and starts saying the Soviet regime is still evil and it's oppression, but there might be a guy named Mikhail Gorbachev with whom I can work.
Right.
And if I can work with him, I will work with him to get peace, not a peace that abandons the principle of freedom, right? But a peace that tries to move the Soviet Union toward openness and perhaps freedom. If that's true, what about his other most famous speech? I mean, probably the time for choosing is, you said statesmen have words, right? And they articulate words, particularly American statesmen, right? Regime built on words, like we hold these truths to be self-evident. His time for choosing speech, his first inaugural.
Right.
And maybe the evil empire speech, but certainly the speech that's, as you referenced already, tear down this wall.
Right. Yeah.
That speech that's given in the later part of the Reagan presidency, after he has been engaged with Gorbachev on things like discussions about reducing intermediate nuclear forces, after he's been engaged in discussions about the Strategic Defense Initiative, then he goes to West Berlin and declares this.
Yeah.
Some people, again, his advisors said, please don't do this.
The State Department said, don't do this.
We've had Peter Robinson, who wrote the line.
Yeah.
And Robinson thought, he's told me, he looked out over East Berlin and just said, it's what has happened to those people is evil. Yeah. It has to be called out. The wall must go. He puts the line in there. Reagan loves the line. All of his advisors, including people in the diplomatic service in East Germany or West Germany, say, don't do this. They exit out. He puts it back in. Why? How is that an example of Reagan's statesmanship?
Can you imagine you're Mikhail Gorbachev? I mean, here he is, like, all right, we've made progress. We're starting to talk about arms reduction. We've become friendly. And you sit here on my front porch and tell me to tear down the wall. Oof, man, that's got to seem like a serious gut punch.
And yeah, because he doesn't off. Just I mean, say the Soviets should tear down this wall.
Mr. Gorbachev.
Mr. Gorbachev, right?
He calls him out by name. Yes, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Wow. I mean, the courage to say that, first of all, but then just the clarity. I mean, if you put your money where your mouth is, Mr. Gorbachev. You're talking about openness. If you really are committed to this, tear down this wall. I was a kid. I lived in Berlin when he gave that speech. My old man was working security for that event. My dad was in the Air Force. I mean, you know, we saw clips of that for weeks and, you know, the crowds erupting. And, like, you can see that, I mean, how well it was received by the audience. What an amazing line. And that's now, of course, now that's the line that the speech is known. That's what it's called. It's called the Tear Down This Wall speech. What greater words has I'm going to ask this rhetorically and trying to ask if I can actually answer it. What more famous words have ever been uttered by a U.S. president on foreign soil? It's not clear to me. I don't know that there is one. I mean, Kennedy's speech in Berlin also had some memorable lines, famously mistranslating something back into German. But I think that might be it. Now, of course, now I'll have to rack my brains and I'll come up with something better later. But I mean, these are maybe the most memorable words spoken by a U.S. president on foreign soil. I think that's fair to say.
It's a fair estimate, sure.
Yeah.
He was not afraid to call on Gorbachev to do this because he believed that Gorbachev needed to be a carrot, but also a stick. He needed to be pressured.
Right.
But also, if you do this, then we will be open with you. But you have to do something.
So, Gorbachev had said this glasnost, perestroika, we're committed to openness, we're committed to change. And so let me just read a little bit from Reagan's speech. So what Reagan is doing here in the speech is he's taking Gorbachev's words very seriously and saying, okay, you've said you now have principles, live up to those principles. So here's Reagan in the speech. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state, or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. And then he says, there's one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. Here I'll just insert my own editorializing. Okay, you say you're about change, you say you're about openness. Here's one sign, here's one thing you can do that would prove it. And back to Reagan. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. So it's kind of holding him to account for what he's been saying. And, you know, I'm 1987. I'm a 10-year-old kid. I probably shouldn't say how old I am. It was unimaginable to me that the Berlin Wall would ever go away. And I remember, less than 2 years later, by this point we had moved to the States, watching on television Berliners dancing on the top of the wall and tearing it down. It was the most unreal thing. Nothing in my entire life politically has surpassed that moment of just wild exuberance and surprise. It was unimaginable to me that, you know, of course I supported Reagan. I was just a kid, but I'd hoped maybe that the Berlin Wall would go away one day, but then, you know, less than 2 years later, it happens. It's kind of crazy.
Well, you were there and you were in West Berlin when you looked out over East Berlin. Right. And looked at the wall and looked at East Berlin.
Yeah.
What struck you?
Yeah, so I was a kid, so seeing it through kids' eyes and now reflecting on it through an adult's eyes. First, I think it's probably one of the major reasons I've become interested in politics, having grown up in Berlin. Seeing a city, seeing that politics is so important for how everyday people live their lives. It's not just something that, you know, politicians and kings and aristocrats, it's not just a game they play and the rest of us can go on living our lives as ordinary humans. That's just not right. And the kind of regime we live under affects so much about how we live our lives. And I can remember as a kid, the evil part was clear to me. They're just evil. And so I can remember looking out and as a young person and just thinking, gosh, just how evil those people are. And then I remember once as a young kid, there was a Soviet guard, or an East German guard with an AK-47 and a, a tower looking at me. I was also in a tower. And in West Berlin, you can look into East Berlin. From our side, you could look into East Berlin, but there were not towers for East Berliners to look into West Berlin. That was not allowed, except for the military guards. And this guy had an AK-47, and he's looking at me, and I was looking at him. I was like, this evil guy, evil East German communist. And he smiled and waved at me. And then I was like, wait a minute. That's, you know, he's just a 20-year-old kid probably. I didn't think this sophisticatedly about it, but I thought, this is a nice guy. And then you look out over East Berlin, you see the poverty and the pain and the tyranny and the lack of freedom. And I mostly just felt, pity for them. I mean, I can remember there were a few attempts of East Berliners to escape into West Berlin while I was living there. And on at least one occasion, I have a memory of a wreath where I remember seeing something on the ground that looked like it might have been blood to me, where maybe someone had unsuccessfully tried to escape. And it was just profound sadness. Like, why is this regime so desperate to hold on to people that they can't just let them leave if they want to leave? So, I mean, from the eyes of the kids, and this is why I think Reagan was and remains so powerful to me, an example of statesmanship and being a good politician, is to not equivocate about this. I mean, this really is evil, what they were doing. And to say that and to try and improve the lives of ordinary citizens of another country or subjects of another country. I mean, Reagan, they were also trying to help figure out ways to develop agricultural things to help feed Russians. Like that, I mean, like, who does that? Who tries to feed their enemies? Really was about peace and prosperity and freedom for all mankind.
In his farewell address, once Reagan has ended his second term, he says in his farewell address, I'm going to continue the tradition of Washington and give a farewell address. And one of the things that he says something very interesting, which is what he's most proud of. And of course, the Soviet Union has not yet fallen because, of course, it's 1989 right. then. But he says, I'm most proud of the fact that we have revived the American economy. So right. on the domestic side, as you said, extended the principles of freedom to things like tax policy, regulatory policy. Mm-hmm. We've revived the American economy. And we've revived patriotism in the United States.
Yes.
He says, these two things I count as my great achievements.
Informed patriotism, by the way, he says.
Well, that's right. But I have to give you a warning, which is this patriotism won't last unless it's informed patriotism.
Very good.
So that young people love America because they understand why it's lovable.
Yes.
Why was that such a concern for Reagan that he would highlight it in the last public thing he says as president to his fellow Americans?
I mean, that far-seeing and prudence or whatever that intellectual capacity of a statesman is, I mean, it's easy. I mean, if he sees that the Soviet Union's in its last throes, that can lend itself to a kind of jingoism. I mean, I don't know, like just rah-rah patriotism, vulgar patriotism. And lead to, therefore, to a kind of forgetting about the principles that made us worth saving, that made it great, that made it worth fighting for. Victory can sometimes perhaps blind one to the reasons for one's success. I mean, we can see this in doesn't Reagan also say somewhere else, every generation is, freedom is one generation from being lost or something like this. I paraphrase it, probably butchered it, but like people can forget this and success can make you forget this. And I wonder if Reagan doesn't see like the enormous economic success that you mentioned, there can be some dangers there. And he's right. I mean, I will say, here at the Ashbrook Center, this is one of the reasons we have the podcast, right? It's why we have teacher programs to reach out to high school teachers and why we have the scholar program for college students. This is what we aim to do. You're trying to make informed patriots. Jeff Sickinga, you teach all of our seniors Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he talks about reflective patriotism. We don't want people who love this country because it's theirs. We want people who love this country because its principles are good, because you can read the Constitution and see the sort of practical wisdom that went into developing it, that you can see the justice of the principles as they're articulated in the Declaration of Independence. And that, people like Peter Schramm, who was executive director before you, who could be from Hungary, but come to the United States and become an American. And so it's not enough that people love their country. That's patriotism. What we want is reflective patriotism. And again, that's just Reagan sees that that's what's needed. And where did he get that? Did he read Tocqueville? I don't know. I doubt it. But I mean, to see what Tocqueville saw, that what's needed is a kind of patriotism that is thoughtful. and that understands how things are, and therefore doesn't become closed in a way that a sort of unreflective patriotism can become closed off, I think. I mean, think about the way in which Reagan's patriotism for America helped him as he sought to help other peoples around the world in oppressive regimes. That's thoughtful.
Right, right. Wow, that's fascinating. What an interesting insight into Reagan. I do have to say, we this wonderful new course that we've launched, and you are one of the faculty members who are in this course called Tear Down This Wall. I think Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and the Fight for Freedom. It's such a great, I want to just thank you for your involvement in that, because it's just such a great course and such a great way for folks everywhere, anywhere, to dive into a deeper study of Reagan, a deeper study of Churchill, a deeper study of Thatcher, who was, of course, great friends with Reagan and partners in the same cause. It's such a terrific opportunity for us. And it was a great opportunity for me to be engaged in that conversation with you. And I appreciate you giving us a little taste here of what we can experience fully in that course, and particularly with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, we didn't even talk about his wit, his how he was sort of a model of.
We do talk about that in the course, right?
Yeah, of
he's
course.
He's a famously funny guy.
And so is Lincoln, so is Churchill, so is Thatcher. So maybe there's some, maybe to be a statesman, one has to have a good sense of humor as well. I don't know. But yeah, well, this is really great, Jeff. I appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah. Happy to talk about Reagan anytime. It was my first political role model and remains one of my greatest.
Well, thank you. And for our listeners and audience, if you're interested in that course, again, it's called Tear Down This Wall, and you can find it at courses.ashbrook.org. I think we'll post the links in the notes for anybody who wants to take a look at it. It is terrific, really informative, really engaging and lively. Greg is joined by Professor Chris Perkett and Professor John Mosier, who are real experts on those other statesmen as well. Greg, thanks for taking the time to join us, as always, on The American Idea.
Thanks, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.